Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I'm sure if we tried, we could think of something less sexy than international banking regulations. But for a certain slice of the global economy, namely the slice that controls all the money, Basel, Switzerland is where it's at. There are some important new rules today for how much money banks have to keep in the bank. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Nixon Peabody LLP, a full-service international law firm offering practical solutions for today's real-world business challenges. More at nixonpeabody.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 13th of September today, and Basel, Switzerland was the center of the banking universe this weekend. The subject at hand, something called Tier 1 capital requirements, does not, we admit, roll trippingly off the tongue. But normally, straight-laced banking regulators are, relatively speaking, passionate about it. They say the agreement, known as Basel III to the in-crowd, might just be the most important thing yet to help avoid future crises. Banks are going to have to triple their reserves as a guard against loans going bad. Our Washington Bureau Chief Don Dimsdale reports.
By requiring banks to set aside $7 for every $100 they lend, regulators hope to even out the ups and downs of the banking economy. Some wanted an even fatter cushion. Douglas Elliott of the Brookings Institution says 7% is watered down, but he understands why.
There's a really important trade-off here, which is we know that requiring more capital makes banks safer, but it also makes it more expensive for them to lend. That hurts the economy. I'd have liked to see a little more safety purchased by a little less economic growth.
During boom times, when lending is strong, banks will be required to build up their capital. That'll help avoid bubbles when banks go after too many loans, and it sets aside money for a rainy day, says Accenture bank analyst Edwin van der Odera.
Clearly, in bad times, it's difficult to build up the cushion because that's when you need it. So therefore, they say banks should be asked to increase the size of the cushion when things are going well, rather than just give all the money back to shareholders. And then they can start absorbing shocks gradually as they go during the bad times.
U.S. banks say they can live with the new capital requirements since they already have, for the most part, built up that cushion. Scott Talbot is with the industry's Financial Services Roundtable.
If you remember last year, U.S. banks went through a stress test with buffer capital requirements. So U.S. capital levels are high. European banks aren't quite as high.
That vulnerability prompted Europe to demand that the capital requirements be phased in over 8 years, which some criticize as too long. Still, the agreement is expected to be ratified by the leaders of the G20 industrial countries when they meet next in November. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Come with me now to a different world, a world where there are no Wi-Fi dead zones, no slow internet connections that make downloads more trouble than they're worth. It is possible, you know, the Federal Communications Commission is meeting next week to talk about something called white space, a chunk of the airwaves that aren't used at the moment, and whether or not to make that chunk available to the public. It could, if everything works out, lead to all kinds of new devices and make your current gadgets work better and faster. From North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin reports.
Think of the airwaves like real estate on the Monopoly board. Back in 1985, the FCC opened up the low-rent Baltic Avenue of the frequency spectrum. These waves could barely penetrate walls, and no company wanted them. But Daniel Berninger with GoCypher says those waves are why we now have everything from garage door openers to Wi-Fi.
The whole Wi-Fi universe and all the money that's made on Wi-Fi was an accidental consequence of opening up this area of spectrum.
The frequencies the FCC will address next week are the airwaves between TV channels. They easily penetrate walls and can travel fast over long distances.
So this is definitely beachfront or, you know, boardwalk property.
Big tech companies like Google, Microsoft, and Dell are anxious to use this spectrum to deliver more content faster. It could also launch a new round of innovations and applications. Telecom attorney Robert Reaney at Reaney Curran can't wait for this one.
The ability of refrigerators, for example, to talk to your computer to remind them that you've run out of milk.
Yeah, just what the world needs.
I, for one, have young children at home, so I would find that a very valuable tool, particularly if it was emailed to my wireless portable email.
If the FCC does free up this white space, it will most benefit rural areas that may have limited access to wireless networks. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Investigators are still trying to figure out why a huge natural gas pipeline exploded just south of San Francisco last week. At least 4 people were killed. More than 50 homes were destroyed. President Obama said last week that he wants to spend $50 billion on infrastructure repairs, none of it targeted at gas pipelines. We asked Marketplace's Jeff Tyler, why not?
The federal government oversees the regulation of gas pipelines, but it doesn't pay for them. Martin Edwards with the Interstate Natural Gas Association of America says private companies can reap
fairly attractive returns on the investment that's made, and that percent of return on investment is sufficient to attract a pretty significant amount of private capital.
Edwards says that private capital pays for maintaining and repairing gas pipelines. Some watchdogs worry that the explosion in California might skew the debate.
We don't want concern over the tragedy in San Bruno to become a blank check.
That's Mindy Spatt with the Churn Utility Reform Network. She says the local utility, PG&E, needs to be held responsible.
The aging infrastructure is a concern and probably does need some attention paid to it. But this particular pipeline, the maintenance of it is something that PG&E was responsible for. And if there's one thing PG&E has plenty of, it's money.
If the federal government decides it wants to invest directly in gas pipelines, one component of the president's new infrastructure stimulus plan could help. A proposed infrastructure bank would allow the government to circumvent political horse trading and spend money on the country's most pressing infrastructure needs. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Those new rules on bank capital help Wall Street start the week on a high note. We will have the details when we always have the details. There was a brief moment of agreement on tax policy over the weekend. House Minority Leader John Boehner said he would vote to let Bush-era tax cuts on rich Americans expire, as the White House would like, if that was the only way to save tax cuts for the middle class. Senate Republicans said today they will agree to no such thing, so we're back to more of the same with the midterm elections looming. Commentator Rehan Salam has another part of the tax code he wishes would get some attention.
Hundreds of thousands of Americans have left home to serve as ambassadors of American capitalism. Many are corporate employees working for big multinationals. Others are hungry entrepreneurs looking to profit from white-hot economic growth in countries like China, India, and Brazil. They spread the gospel of the profit motive. And they also help drive what scholars call brain circulation, which benefits the U.S. economy. Consider the Indian-American immigrant who goes back home to his native Bangalore to launch a tech startup. He takes his Silicon Valley know-how to the old country, but he also brings back knowledge about the growing Indian market to the U.S. by keeping in touch with old colleagues. That helps U.S. firms and Indian firms profit from each other's success. But the problem is that the U.S. is the only industrialized country that taxes its citizens on income earned abroad. That means successful American expats have to pay taxes to the IRS on top of taxes to their country of residence. Complex new regulations are making matters worse. This has led a tiny trickle of expats to actually renounce their citizenship or their green cards. We're in danger of losing some of our most talented citizens for good. We ought to encourage Americans to work abroad, not punish them for it. At the very least, we should stop taxing expats for income earned in their country of residence. The truth is that all Americans profit from having a large U.S. diaspora sprinkled across the globe. They spread ideas, but they also find ideas and use them to jumpstart new trends. Think of all the cuisines and movies and technologies we'd miss out on without them. Many will say good riddance. Who needs these economic Benedict Arnolds? But that's a short-sighted view that will leave all Americans worse off.
Rehan Salam is a policy advisor at E21. That's an economics think tank. We would love to know what you think. You can visit our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. There are songs that put you in a good mood. There are songs you listen to when you're blue, songs you work out to, and songs you put on just to get by. That's the idea behind our series Road Warriors from producer Michael Rayfield. The soundtracks that business travelers use to get through those long hours away from home. Today's installment is a song of marriage and home and love.
Hi, my name is Amit Chavla, and I'm an independent software consultant. When I'm on the road and I have to travel, one thing that brings me back home is the song Terebin by Ravi Shergill.
Terebin san sonya koi ho nahi
lagda. The singer is Punjabi, the lyrics are in Punjabi, which is a North Indian language. It means without you. In the song, he's talking about his wife or significant other and how much he's come to respect her and how he can't live without her, actually. It really struck a resonant chord with me, especially on the road. It's you're away from your family, and we have a young family. We have two kids. It's tough being away from them, even though while I'm with them, I'm complaining they won't go to sleep, they won't eat properly, they run into my office and reboot my computer at will. As much as I complain about them, I can't sleep in a hotel room soundly. At the beginning, it was an adventure. I felt kind of like a hobbit going out on an adventure, sort of like Bilbo Baggins the first time he stepped out of the Shire. But after, I'd say, the first month or so of business travel, the charm sort of wears off, and it sort of becomes a grind. But I've sort of accepted it as a part of the business. I've chosen this line of work. And for better or for worse, it's afforded us a great lifestyle. But that means, I'm on the road. And on the road means having to deal with security lines, airports, rental car, shuttles, weather delays, bad food, good food. I mean, all of it. You know, it's sort of like complaining about the heat in Texas in August. Can't really do anything about it. Ruby talks about traveling the world. He says he's been to America, he's been to Russia, to Malaysia, all over the world, and everybody's asking him to do different things or ask different things of him. He says, everybody wants something from me, but they only want the good things from me. No one wants everything from me, like all my good and my bad, except you. It strikes a chord with me because, we can talk about all the romantic notions of, a relationship or marriage and stuff like that, and everybody would like to think it's perfect. But sometimes it's not perfect, and it takes effort. And at the end of the day, at the end of every day, I said, it's absolutely worth it. But sometimes you have to remind yourself of that. And when he talks about travel, it hits home with me. It's almost like an emotional response.
We've got a new music section on our website. That is the place to check out Amit's other favorites and offer up your own playlist. It is marketplace.org. Coming up, what recession means for a company town.
When consumers across the country quit buying manufactured products, we suffer.
A visit to Kingsport, Tennessee, but first, let's do the numbers. The new banking guidelines we told you about gave Wall Street a boost today. The Dow Industrials lofted 81 points, more than 0.75%. Closed to 10,544. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ up 43 points, nearly 2%, 2285 at the bell. The S&P 500 tacked on 12 points, just over 1%, wrapped up at 1121. No surprise, it was a good day for bank stocks. J.P. Morgan Chase added nearly 3.5%. Bank of America rolled up almost 3%. Goldman Sachs polished up more than 2.5%. Today, elsewhere, Hewlett-Packard continued its buying spree. The computer giant announced it's acquiring security software maker ArcSight for $1.5 billion. ArcSight jumped 25%. HP edged up 0.2%. Under Rent-A-Car's Dollar Thrifty agreed to be bought by Hertz for more than 1.4 billion. Shares of Hertz raced up nearly 8% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by Constant Contact Event Marketing, working to help small businesses and nonprofits make their events easier with event registration and marketing tools. ConstantContact.com. Coverage of the economy is supported in part by the Schumann Center for Media and Democracy. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for August. In Philadelphia, President Obama addresses kids across the country in his second annual back-to-school speech. And a Senate Committee on Crime and Drugs holds a hearing on rape in the United States, looking specifically at the chronic failure to report and investigate cases. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Fashion Week in New York City. All the newest trends are out on the runways, offering a look at styles to come this spring. Here in L.A., the fashion thing to do, which we have done, is take a stroll down to Santee Alley in downtown. A lot of what's on display in New York is going to be showing up here in a matter of weeks. It will not, of course, be the real thing, as you can see by this wall of handbags in front of me. That one proposes to be an Ed Hardy bag, but for $29.99, I don't think so. That one's a Birkin knockoff, I'm pretty sure. There's Burberry across the way and a Gucci as well. But for a lot of people, the fakes are close enough, and they are just the right price. Cheap. For everybody here contemplating a trade in counterfeit goods, though, there is a proposed remedy. Fordham University in New York City is offering a first-of-its-kind program this year in fashion law. Susan Scafidi runs it, and when we spoke, I asked her whether fashion lawyers might go about practicing their trade by doing what we did, going out and seeing what's for sale.
Cruising the knockoffs isn't a bad idea, and certainly one of the things that fashion lawyers do, and certainly our students are already doing that, working with some fashion firms. But really, a fashion lawyer can address any issue that arises throughout the life of a garment, from issues of intellectual property and ownership of the designs, to employment and labor relations issues, real estate issues, customs issues, issues of safety and sustainability and what constitutes green fashion, all the way up to issues that might arise when a consumer wears clothing. What is she permitted to wear to work, to school? So all of those questions are part of the life of a fashion lawyer.
Can you copyright a design? I mean, you can't copyright a book title, can you?
Kai, no, you cannot copyright a fashion design in the United States at this point. However, I've been very involved working on legislation that would permit copywriting of fashion designs, or rather a very, very short-term form of copyright, a 3-year copyright. A good fashion lawyer needs to know the basics of the intellectual property system, but also get creative and borrow from areas of intellectual property law that might apply. We're talking about the trademarks that protect labels and logos, for example. So it's about getting creative with the law out there and learning to apply it to the special needs of the fashion industry.
And you can go to any fashion district in any city in this country or in the world and find knockoff after knockoff after knockoff. It does seem like your fight is without end.
Trying to shut down counterfeits and knockoffs is a little bit like trying to empty the ocean with a teaspoon. I think that the consumer doesn't always understand the potential harm from carrying that fake Louis Vuitton purse. And the harm is particularly intense when it comes not to the big companies, but to the little ones, the ones whose names you might not even know, but whose designs are stolen, sometimes even before they can get those designs to market.
How does this fit, this movement you're trying to start of fashion law and its importance in the industry? How does it fit in a world where you have things like Project Runway, where, you know, this design thing has become kind of a game?
The idea of design being part of our culture is also part of what's making it more possible to respect and protect design. Once upon a time, fashion was that frivolous thing that girls did, that women did, maybe some gay men did, but surely not the upstanding members of the bench and bar who were attired in their pinstripes or their black robes. Now, as fashion becomes more and more part of American culture, it becomes something that we respect and therefore something that we protect as a key element of our economy and as a creative medium that we find enchanting and engaging. So fashion law is catching up with how the culture is starting to perceive fashion.
Susan Scafidi, she is the director of the Fashion Law Institute at Fordham Law School in New York City. Susan, thanks a lot.
Kai, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This is an economy where everything depends on everything else. That applies on a global scale, as with the new banking regulations that came out of Basel this weekend that we started with. It applies on a really local level, too. Tomorrow morning, we're going to get manufacturing data for the month of July, how much American manufacturers are making and selling. In those numbers, we are probably going to be able to see the continuing thriftiness of American consumers. We are not buying as much, so factories aren't making as much. In a company town where one plant is the big employer, that's bad news for locals no matter where they work. Marketplace Jeremy Hobson continues his travels through Tennessee now for our series on how the recession and the recovery are being felt in the heartland.
To look at the sunny side of everything and make your optimism come true.
It's a warm evening in the East Tennessee hill town of Kingsport. And as they do each week, members of the Optimist Club have gathered at the Lynn Garden Restaurant to plan their good deeds. But it's a struggle to remain optimistic around here these days. Mary Underwood is the wife of a club member. She used to do community outreach for a medical office.
They called me in about a year and a half ago and told me they can no longer afford me in that position.
Since her layoff, she's been able to pick up a lower paying job. But she says,
I'm making about $1,200 a month less. I stopped putting into retirement, so I'm going to school part-time to get a degree, hopefully, in medical lab technology so I can regain that income.
Her 22-year-old son hasn't fared any better. He's been unable to find steady work as a welder and is still living at home. And all over town, the story is the same. From a small business owner named Jack Ganaway.
It doesn't look good right now. You know, a lot of my clients are, you know, cutting back. You know, you don't have any money left to put back in your business.
To a hairdresser named Kimberly Moneyhun.
People will go longer in between times if they can hold off haircuts for another week or two, make it last. So I felt it a lot.
That's because everything in Kingsport revolves around the chemical company Eastman. It employs one out of every seven people here. Bob Underwood is Mary's husband, a local pastor and senior member of the Optimist Club.
It used to be a big time of the year when Eastman had their bonuses. And, I mean, companies really pushed for those bonuses for them to come in and spend their money. And you don't see that now.
Underwood says as the national economy has dipped further into recession, this manufacturing hub has fallen right along with it. Last year, Eastman laid off about 5% of its workforce, and employees who stayed on the job took a temporary cut in pay.
The way Eastman goes, really so goes the community.
That's because the materials that go into the things we buy in New York, Los Angeles, and everywhere in between are made right here in Kingsport. Wayne Chastain is a chemical engineer for the company.
You know, we're in paints, we're in adhesives, we're in plastics. And so when consumers stop buying, we definitely do feel it.
And neighboring communities are feeling it too. They're the makers of everything from paper to ammunition.
Blount County here, almost one in four jobs in manufacturing.
Matt Murray is a regional economist at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. He met me outside a brand new office park that has no tenants yet.
Statewide, we're closer to around 15% of our jobs in manufacturing. That's substantially higher than the national average. And so when consumers across the country quit buying manufactured products, we suffer. When they quit buying building materials, because we have a fairly strong lumber industry in Tennessee and so on, this economy suffers.
He says many of the laborers who came here for manufacturing jobs have fled to larger cities. Immigrant workers, he says, may have left the country altogether. As for those who've stuck around, waiting for a rebound?
I really don't know what these people are going to do. They've borne the brunt of the weight of the recession, but looking forward, it is very hard for me to see where the opportunity will be once the economy begins to grow again. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Back at the Optimist Club meeting in Kingsport, Wayne McConnell worries for the next generation. He's retired now, but spent most of his life working at a paper mill. I asked him who he blames for the hurt here, and he starts with Washington.
I'm about to the point that in my book, they need to load all of them in Washington up on a big plane, take them over and turn them loose in Afghanistan, and leave them over there.
But McConnell saves his real anger for Wall Street bankers.
In my book, they ought to hang them. I mean, when you take bailout money and then you pay them $2 or $3 million bonus, now, something ain't right there on that. Now, we're not used to that high-paying job down here, though, I don't think.
There's no doubt about that. The average person here makes about $20,000 a year. McConnell says many of the workers at his old paper mill are in their 70s. He says they're afraid if they retire, they won't be able to make it. In Kingsport, Tennessee, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today. You know how a lot of people have been lamenting the death of news in this era of blogs and Twitter and instantaneous communication? Yeah, well, not so dead after all, say the good people at the Pew Center for the People and the Press. A survey out this weekend shows we are spending exactly the same amount of time every day getting the news from newspapers, television, and radio, 57 minutes, as we did 10 years ago. Add in the 13 minutes a day we're online finding out what's going on, and we're as news savvy as we've been in 15 years, they say. Now, as to who's paying for that online news, well, that's a whole different story, and we are out of time. That's American Public Media's Marketplace on this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 81 points, more than 0.75%. The NASDAQ rose 43 points, nearly 2%. The S&P 500 tacked on 12 points, just over 1%. Our producers include Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program, blogging, taxes, and the city of brotherly love.
There is no blog tax. The problem that the bloggers are encountering is that Philadelphia is not a welcoming place to be an entrepreneur, period.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.